The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners at 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Radio. We are finally finishing The House on the Borderland. It feels like forever, but we're reaching the end of this insane story. But I love it, so, and I hope you love it too, so we'll continue. House in the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. The Thing from the Arena. This morning early, I went through the gardens, but found everything as usual. Near the door, I examined the path for footprints, yet here again there was nothing to tell me whether or not I dreamed last night. It was only when I came to speak to the dog that I discovered tangible proof that something did happen. When I went to his kennel, he kept inside, crouching up in one corner, and I had to coax him to get him out. When finally he consented to come, he was in a strangely cowed and subdued manner. As I patted him, my attention was attracted to a greenish patch on his left flank. On examining it, I found that the fur and skin had been apparently burnt off, for the flesh showed raw and scorched. The shape of the mark was curious, reminding me of the imprint of a large talon or hand. I stood up thoughtful. My gaze wandered toward the study window. The rays of the rising sun shimmered on the smoky patch in the lower corner, causing it to fluctuate from green to red oddly. Ah, that was undoubtedly another proof. And suddenly the horrible thing I saw last night rose in my mind. I looked at the dog again. I knew the cause now of that hateful-looking wound on his side. I knew also that what I had seen last night had been real. And a great discomfort filled me. Pepper, Tip, and now this poor animal. I glanced at the dog again and noticed that he was licking at his wound. "Poor brute," I muttered, and bent to pat his head. At that, he got up upon his feet, nosing and licking my hand wistfully. Presently I left him, having other matters to which to attend. After dinner I went to see him again. He seemed quiet and disinclined to leave his kennel. From my sister I have learnt that he has refused all food today. She appeared a little puzzled when she told me, though quite unsuspicious of anything of which to be afraid. The day has passed uneventfully enough. After tea, I went again to have a look at the dog. He seemed moody and somewhat restless, yet persisted in remaining in his kennel. But before locking up for the night, I moved his kennel out away from the wall so that I shall be able to watch it from the small window tonight. The thought came to me to bring him into the house for the night. Consideration has decided me to let him remain out. I cannot say that the house is, in any degree, less to be feared than the gardens. Pepper was in the house, and yet... It is now 2 o'clock. Since 8, I have watched the kennel from the small side window in my study. Yet nothing has occurred, and I am too tired to watch longer. I will go to bed. During the night, I was restless. This is unusual for me, but towards morning, I obtained a few hours' sleep. I rose early and after breakfast visited the dog. He was quiet but morose and refused to leave his kennel. I wish there was some horse doctor near here. I would have the poor brute looked to. All day he has taken no food but has shown an evident desire for water, lapping it up greedily. I was relieved to observe this. The evening has come and I am in my study. I intend to follow my plan of last night and watch the kennel. The door leading into the garden is bolted securely. I am consciously glad there are bars on the windows. Night. Midnight has gone. The dog has been silent up to the present. Through the side window on my left, I can make out dimly the outlines of the kennel. For the first time, the dog moves, and I hear the rattle of his chain. I look out quickly. As I stare, the dog moves again restlessly. And I see a small patch of luminous light shine from the interior of the kennel. It vanishes. Then the dog stirs again, and once more the gleam comes. I am puzzled. The dog is quiet, and I can see the luminous thing plainly. It shows distinctly. There is something familiar about the shape of it. For a moment, I wonder, and it comes to me that it is not unlike the four fingers and thumb of a hand. Like a hand. And I remember the contour of that fearsome wound on the dog's side. It must be the wound I see. It is luminous at night. Why? The minutes pass. My mind is filled with this fresh thing. Suddenly I hear a sound out in the gardens. How it thrills through me. It is approaching. Pad, pad, pad. A prickly sensation traverses my spine and seems to creep across my scalp. The dog moves in his kennel and whimpers frighteningly. He must have turned round, for now I can no longer see the outline of his shining wound. Outside, the gardens are silent once more, and I listen fearfully. A minute passes, and another. Then I hear the padding sound again. It is quite close and appears to be coming down the gravel path. The noise is curiously measured and deliberate. It ceases outside the door, and I rise to my feet and stand motionless. From the door comes a slight sound. The latch is being slowly raised. A singing noise is in my ears, and I have a sense of pressure about the head. The latch drops with a sharp click into the catch. The noise startles me afresh, jarring horribly on my tense nerves. After that, I stand for a long while amid an ever-growing quietness. All at once, my knees begin to tremble, and I have to sit quickly. An uncertain period of time passes, and gradually I begin to shake off the feeling of terror that has possessed me. Yet still I sit. I seem to have lost the power of movement. I am strangely tired and inclined to doze. My eyes open and close, and presently I find myself falling asleep and waking in fits and starts. It is some time later that I am sleepily aware that one of the candles is guttering. When I wake again, it has gone out, and the room is very dim under the light of the one remaining flame. The semi-darkness troubles me little. I have lost that awful sense of dread, and my only desire seems to be sleep. Sleep. Suddenly, although there is no noise, I am awake, wide awake. I am acutely conscious of the nearness of some mystery, of some overwhelming presence. The very air seems pregnant with terror. I sit huddled and just listen intently. Still, there is no sound. Nature herself seems dead. Then the oppressive stillness is broken by a little eldritch scream of wind that sweeps round the house and dies away remotely. I let my gaze wander across the half-lighted room. By the great clock in the far corner is a dark, tall shadow. For a short instant I stare frightenedly. Then I see that it is nothing and am momentarily relieved. In the time that follows, a thought flashes through my brain. Why not leave this house of mystery and terror? Then, as though in answer, there sweeps up across my sight a vision of the wondrous sea of sleep, the sea of sleep where she and I have been allowed to meet after the years of separation and sorrow, and I know that I shall stay on here, whatever happens. Through the side window, I note the somber blackness of the night. My glance wanders away and round the room, resting on one shadowy object and another. Suddenly I turn and look at the window on my right. As I do so, I breathe quickly and bend forward with a frightened gaze at something outside the window, but close to the bars. I am looking at a vast, misty swine face, over which fluctuates a flamboyant flame of a greenish hue. It is the thing from the arena. The quivering mouth seems to drip with a continual, phosphorescent slaver. The eyes are staring straight into the room with an inscrutable expression. Thus I sit rigidly, frozen. The thing has begun to move. It is turning slowly in my direction. Its face is coming round towards me. It sees me. Two huge, inhumanly human eyes are looking through the dimness at me. I am cold with fear, yet even now I am keenly conscious and note, in an irrelevant way, that the distant stars are blotted out by the mass of the giant face. A fresh horror has come to me. I am rising from my chair without the least intention. I am on my feet, and something is impelling me towards a door that leads out into the gardens. I wish to stop, but cannot. Some immutable power is opposed to my will, and I go slowly forward, unwilling and resistant. My glance flies round the room helplessly and stops at the window. The great swine face has disappeared, and I hear again that stealthy pad, pad, pad. It stops outside the door towards which I am being compelled. There succeeds a short, intense silence. Then there comes a sound. It is the rattle of the latch being slowly lifted. At that, I am filled with desperation. I will not go forward another step. I make a vast effort to return, but it is as though I press back upon an invisible wall. I groan out loud in the agony of my fear, and the sound of my voice is frightening. Again comes that rattle, and I shiver clammily. I try, I fight and struggle to hold back, back, but it is no use. I am at the door, and in a mechanical way I watch my hand go forward to undo the topmost bolt. It does so entirely without my volition. Even as I reach up towards the bolt, the door is violently shaken, and I get a sickly whiff of moldy air which seems to drive in through the interstices of the doorway. I draw the bolt back slowly, fighting dumbly the while. It comes out of its socket with a click, and I begin to shake aguishly. There are two more, one at the bottom of the door, the other, a massive affair, is placed about the middle. For perhaps a minute I stand with my arms hanging slackly by my sides. The influence to meddle with the fastenings of the door seems to have gone. All at once there comes a sudden rattle of iron at my feet. I glance down quickly and realize, with an unspeakable terror, that my foot is pushing back the lower bolt. An awful sense of helplessness assails me. The bolt comes out of its hold with a slight ringing sound, and I stagger on my feet, grasping at the great central bolt for support. A minute passes, an eternity, then another. My God, help me! I am being forced to work upon the last fastening. I will not. Better to die than open to the terror that is on the other side of the door. Is there no escape? God help me, I am jerked the bolt half out of its socket. My lips emit a hoarse scream of terror. The bolt is three parts drawn now, and still my unconscious hands work towards my doom. Only a fraction of steel between my soul and that. Twice I scream out in the supreme agony of my fear. Then, with a mad effort, I tear my hands away. My eyes seem blinded. A great blackness is falling upon me. Nature has come to my rescue. I feel my knees giving. There is a loud, quick thudding upon the door, and I am falling, falling. I must have lain there at least a couple of hours. As I recover, I am aware that the other candle is burnt out, and the room is in an almost total darkness. I cannot rise to my feet, for I am cold and filled with a terrible cramp. Yet my brain is clear, and there is no longer the strain of that unholy influence. Cautiously, I get upon my knees and feel for the central bolt. I find it and push it securely back into its socket, then the one at the bottom of the door. By this time, I am able to rise to my feet and so manage to secure the fastening at the top. After that, I go down upon my knees again and creep away among the furniture in the direction of the stairs. By doing this, I am safe from observation from the window. I reach the opposite door, and as I leave the study, cast one nervous glance over my shoulder towards the window. Out in the night, I seem to catch a glimpse of something impalpable, but it may be only a fancy. Then I am in the passage and on the stairs. Reaching my bedroom, I clamber into bed, all clothed as I am, and pull the bedclothes over me. There, after a while, I begin to regain a little confidence. It is impossible to sleep, but I am grateful for the added warmth of the bedclothes. Presently, I try to think over the happenings of the past night, but though I cannot sleep, I find that it is useless to attempt consecutive thought. My brain seems curiously blank. Towards morning, I begin to toss uneasily. I cannot rest, and after a while, I get out of bed and pace the floor. The wintry dawn is beginning to creep through the windows and shows the bare discomfort of the old room. Strange that, through all these years, it has never occurred to me how dismal the place really is. And so a time passes. From somewhere downstairs, a sound comes up to me. I go to the bedroom door and listen. It is Mary, bustling about the great old kitchen, getting the breakfast ready. I feel little interest. I am not hungry. My thoughts, however, continue to dwell upon her. How little the weird happenings in this house seem to trouble her. Except in the incident of the pit creatures, she has seemed unconscious of anything unusual occurring. She is old, like myself, yet how little we have to do with one another. Is it because we have nothing in common, or only that, being old, we care less for society than quietness? These and other matters pass through my mind as I meditate, and help to distract my attention for a while from the oppressive thoughts of the night. After a time, I go to the window, and opening it, look out. The sun is now above the horizon, and the air, though cold, is sweet and crisp. Gradually, my brain clears, and a sense of security for the time being comes to me. Somewhat happier, I go downstairs and out into the garden to have a look at the dog. As I approach the kennel, I am greeted by the same moldy stench that assailed me at the door last night. Shaking off a momentary sense of fear, I call to the dog, but he takes no heed, and after calling once more, I throw a small stone into the kennel. At this he moves uneasily, and I shout his name again, but do not go closer. Presently, my sister comes out and joins me in trying to coax him from the kennel. In a little, the poor beast rises and shambles out, lurching strangely. Wait, let me try one more time. Blah. In a little, the poor beast rises and shambles out, lurching strangely. In the daylight, he stands swaying from side to side and blinking stupidly. I look and note that the horrid wound is larger, much larger. Wait, let me try that one more time. Blah. I look and note that the horrid wound is larger, much larger, and seems to have a whitish, fungoid appearance. My sister moves to fondle him, but I detain her and explain that I think it will be better not to go near him for a few days, as it is impossible to tell what may be the matter with him, and as well to be cautious. A minute later, she leaves me, coming back with a basin of odd scraps of food. This she places on the ground near the dog, and I push it into his reach with the aid of a branch broken from one of the shrubs. Yet, though the meat should be tempting, he takes no notice of it, but retires to his kennel. There is still water in his drinking vessel, so after a few moments' talk, we go back to the house. I can see that my sister is much puzzled as to what is the matter with the animal, yet it would be madness even to hint the truth to her. The day slips away uneventfully, and night comes on. I have determined to repeat my experiment of last night. I cannot say that it is wisdom, yet my mind is made up. Still, however, I have taken precautions, for I have driven stout nails in at the back of each of the bolts that secure the door opening from the study into the gardens. This will, at least, prevent a recurrence of the danger I ran last night. From 10 to about 2:30, I watch, but nothing occurs, and finally I stumble off to bed, where I am soon asleep. Getting creepy, but it's always creepy, isn't it? We'll see where this goes, but first, a message from our sponsor.
You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, and 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Hey, it's Sean from WTBR-FM. Whether you just found this station for the first time or you've been listening for years, you might not know everything about WTBR-FM. Want to find out more? It's easy. Just go to WTBRFM.com. You can find full programming schedules, listen to the station anywhere in the world, subscribe to our podcasts, and even learn to create a program of your own. And of course, donate to the station. That's WTBRFM.com. Check it out today.
The Pittsfield Health Department is hosting monthly wellness clinics available to the community at the Christian Center, Senior Center, Epworth Arms, Capitol Square, and South Congregational Church. Vital sign checks, medication reviews, and health assessments are offered by the public health nurse. Our social worker will be there with information of available resources as well. For more information about these clinics, please contact us at 413-499-9411.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Hi, my name is Al Perlman, and I love jazz. Mostly jazz from the bebop and beyond period of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I also love sharing my passion for jazz from my extensive jazz vinyl collection with listeners here in Berkshire County. So please join me on Sundays at 8 p.m. for my show Jazz Collector Live on WTBR-FM Pittsfield Community Radio.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sondrini.com.
You just bought yourself a ticket to Pretzel Town, buddy.
WTBR.
And we're back. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon reading the last of House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. The Luminous Speck. I awake suddenly. It is still dark. I turn over once or twice in my endeavors to sleep again, but I cannot sleep. My head is aching slightly, and by turns I am hot and cold. In a little, I give up the attempt and stretch out my hand for the matches. I will light my candle and read a while. Perhaps I shall be able to sleep after a time. For a few moments, I grope. Then my hand touches the box. But as I open it, I am startled to see a phosphorescent speck of fire shining amid the darkness. I put out my other hand and touch it. It is on my wrist. With a feeling of vague alarm, I strike a light hurriedly and look, but can see nothing save a tiny scratch. Fancy, I mutter with a half sigh of relief. Then the match burns my finger and I drop it quickly. As I fumble for another, the thing shines out again. I know now that it is no fancy. This time I light the candle and examine the place more closely. There is a slight greenish discoloration round the scratch. I am puzzled and worried. And the thought comes to me. I remember the morning after the thing appeared. I remember that the dog licked my hand. It was this one with the scratch on it, though I have not been even conscious of the abrasement until now. A horrible fear has come to me. It creeps into my brain. The dog's wound shines at night. With a dazed feeling, I sit down on the side of the bed and try to think, but cannot. My brain seems numbed with the sheer horror of this new fear. Time moves on, unheeded. Once I rouse up and try to persuade myself that I am mistaken, but it is no use. In my heart, I have no doubt. Hour after hour, I sit in the darkness and silence and shiver hopelessly. The day has come and gone, and it is night again. This morning early, I shot the dog and buried it away among the bushes. My sister is startled and frightened, but I am desperate. Besides, it is better so. The foul growth had almost hidden its left side. And I, the place on my wrist has enlarged perceptibly. Several times I have caught myself muttering prayers. Little things learnt as a child. God, Almighty God, help me. I shall go mad. 6 days, and I have eaten nothing. It is night. I am sitting in my chair. Ah, God, I wonder have any ever felt the horror of life that I have come to know. I am swathed in terror. I feel ever the burning of this dread growth. It has covered all my right arm and side and is beginning to creep up my neck. Tomorrow it will eat into my face. I shall become a terrible mass of living corruption. There is no escape. Yet a thought has come to me, born of a sight of the gun rack on the other side of the room. I have looked again with the strangest of feelings. The thought grows upon me. God, thou knowest, thou must know, that death is better. Aye, better a thousand times than this. This. Jesus, forgive me, but I cannot live. Cannot. I dare not. I am beyond all help. There is nothing else left. It will at least spare me that final horror. I think I must have been dozing. I am very weak, and oh, so miserable and tired. The rustle of the paper tries my brain. My hearing seems preternaturally sharp. I will sit a while and think. Hush, I hear something down in the cellars. It is a creaking sound. By God, it is the opening of the great oak trap. What can be doing that? The scratching of my pen deafens me. I must listen. There are steps on the stairs. Strange, padding steps that come up and nearer. Jesus, be merciful to me, an old man. There is something fumbling at the door handle. Oh, God, help me now. Jesus, the door is opening. Slowly. Something... Editor's note. From the unfinished word, it is possible on the manuscript to trace a faint line of ink which suggests that the pen has trailed away over the paper, possibly through fright and weakness. Conclusion. I put down the manuscript and glanced across at Tonnison. He was sitting, staring out into the dark. I waited a minute, then I spoke. Well? I said. He turned slowly and looked at me. His thoughts seemed to have gone out of him into a great distance. Was he mad? I asked, and indicated the manuscript with a half nod. Tonnison stared at me unseeingly a moment. Then his wits came back to him, and suddenly he comprehended my question. No! He said. I opened my lips to offer a contradictory opinion, for my sense of the sameness of things would not allow me to take the story literally. Then I shut them again without saying anything. Somehow the certainty in Tonnison's voice affected my doubts. I felt, all at once, less assured, though I was by no means convinced as yet.
Yeah.
After a few moments' silence, Tonnison rose stiffly and began to undress. He seemed disinclined to talk, so I said nothing, but followed his example. I was weary, though still full of the story I had just read. Somehow, as I rolled into my blankets, there crept into my mind a memory of the old gardens as we had seen them. I remembered the odd fear that the place had conjured up in our hearts, and it grew upon me with conviction that Tonnison was right. It was very late when we rose, nearly midday, for the greater part of the night had been spent in reading the manuscript. Tonnison was grumpy, and I felt out of sorts. It was a somewhat dismal day, and there was a touch of chilliness in the air. There was no mention of going out fishing on either of our parts. We got dinner, and after that, just sat and smoked in silence. Presently, Tonneson asked for the manuscript. I handed it to him, and he spent most of the afternoon in reading it through by himself. It was while he was thus employed that a thought came to me. "What do you say to having another look at—" I nodded my head downstream. Tonneson looked up. "Nothing," he said abruptly, and somehow I was less annoyed than relieved at his answer. After that, I left him alone. Little before tea time, he looked up at me curiously. "Sorry, old chap, if I was a bit short with you just now." Just now, indeed. He had not spoken for the last 3 hours. "But I would not go there again," and he indicated with his head, "for anything you could offer me. Ugh!" And he put down that history of a man's terror and hope and despair. The next morning we rose early and went for our accustomed swim. We had partly shaken off the depression of the previous day, and so took our rods when we had finished breakfast and spent the day at our favorite spot. After that day we enjoyed our holiday to the utmost, though both of us looked forward to the time when our driver should come, for we were tremendously anxious to inquire of him, and through him among the people of the tiny hamlet, whether any of them could give us information about that strange garden, lying away by itself in the heart of an almost unknown tract of country. At last the day came on which we expected the driver to come across for us. He arrived early while we were still abed, and the first thing we knew, he was at the opening of the tent, inquiring whether we had had good sport. We replied in the affirmative, and then, both together, almost in the same breath, we asked the question that was uppermost in our minds. Did he know anything about an old garden, and a great pit, and a lake situated some miles away down the river? Also, had he ever heard of a great house thereabouts? No, he did not, and had not. Yet, stay, he had heard a rumor, once upon a time, of a great old house standing alone in the wilderness. But, if he had remembered rightly, it was a place given over to the fairies, or, if that had not been so, he was certain that there had been something strange about it, and anyway, he had heard nothing of it for a very long while. Not since he was quite a gossoon. No, he could not remember anything particular about it. Indeed, he did not know he remembered anything at all, until we questioned him. "Look here," said Tonneson, finding that this was about all he could tell us. "Just take a walk round the village while we dress, and find out something, if you can." With a nondescript salute, the man departed on his errand, but we made haste to get into our clothes, after which we began to prepare breakfast. We were just sitting down to it when he returned. "It's all in bed, the lazy divils is, sor," he said, with a repetition of the salute and an appreciative eye to the good things spread out on our provision chest, which we utilized as a table. "Oh, well, sit down," replied my friend, "and have something to eat with us," which the man did without delay. After breakfast, Tonneson sent him off again on the same errand while we sat and smoked. He was away some 3/4 of an hour, and when he returned, it was evident that he had found out something. It appeared that he had got into conversation with an ancient man of the village who probably knew more, though it was little enough, of the strange house than any other person living. The substance of this knowledge was that in this ancient man's youth, and goodness knows how long back that was, there had stood a great house in the center of the gardens where now was left only that fragment of ruin. This house had been empty for a great while, years before his, the ancient man's, birth. It was a place shunned by the people of the village as it had been shunned by their fathers before them. There were many things said about it, and all were of evil. No one ever went near it, either by day or night. In the village it was a synonym of all that is unholy and dreadful. And then, one day, a man, a stranger, had ridden through the village and turned off down the river, in the direction of the house, as it was always termed by the villagers. Some hours afterwards, he had ridden back, taking the track by which he had come towards Ardrahan. Then, for 3 months or so, nothing was heard. At the end of that time, he reappeared, but now he was accompanied by an elderly woman and a large number of donkeys, laden with various articles. They had passed through the village without stopping and gone straight down the bank of the river in the direction of the house. Since that time, no one, save the man whom they had chartered to bring over monthly supplies of necessaries from Ardrahan, had ever seen either of them. And him, none had ever induced to talk, evidently. He had been well paid for his trouble. The years had moved onwards uneventfully enough in that little hamlet, the man making his monthly journeys regularly. One day he had appeared as usual on his customary errand. He had passed through the village without exchanging more than a surly nod with the inhabitants and gone on towards the house. Usually it was evening before he made the return journey. On this occasion, however, he had reappeared in the village a few hours later in an extraordinary state of excitement and with the astounding information that the house had disappeared bodily, and that a stupendous pit now yawned in the place where it had stood. This news, it appears, so excited the curiosity of the villagers that they overcame their fears and marched en masse to the place. There they found everything, just as described by the carrier. This was all that we could learn of the author of the manuscript, who he was and whence he came. We shall never know. His identity is, as he seems to have desired, buried forever. That same day we left the lonely village of Creighton. We have never been there since. Sometimes, in my dreams, I see that enormous pit, surrounded as it is on all sides by wild trees and bushes, and the noise of the water rises upwards and blends, in my sleep, with other and lower noises, while over all hangs the eternal shroud of spray. The end. Well, that was a wild ride we had. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed reading it. This is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners. I will see you next time.